Thank you so much, Warren. He's been doing a phenomenal job as a moderator. You know what they say about Warren? Everything in moderation. It's truly a pleasure to speak after Reverend Dr. Glass. Truth is, he did such a phenomenal job. My role is really somewhat superfluous, and you could argue that there'll be a quality of life issue with my presentation. And if you want to pull the plug on me, but just a point of clarification, actually, which I thank you, Rabbi Dr. Glass, for in my previous presentation, someone had asked me a question in the course of my answer. I mentioned that that Shiva, that he said that after someone passes away, and the rites is biblical. And Rabbi Dr. Glass corrects me. Of course, Shiva is not explicitly mentioned in the Torah. There are some allusions to the fact that it may be biblical, but clearly nothing explicit in the Torah that says that Shiva is the right. When one talks about this, if you don't mind, if I thank you. This is a topic
I forgot to hook you up.
No problem.
I'll just clip it right to your side there.
Sure.
Anywhere and you can have a cell phone in your pocket.
Great. Excellent. Okay, great. Since we are speaking about end-of-life issues, I'll share with you this interesting story about cause of death. There was an archaeologist in the south of Israel who was doing an archaeological dig, and in the course of the archaeological dig, he came across a skeleton, and he was quite excited. And he examined the skeleton and the surrounding archaeological aspects of this find. And he immediately called the curator of the Natural Science Museum, Natural History Museum, and he said, "I have found an exquisite specimen, which I believe is roughly 3,000 years old and died of heart failure." So the natural scientist and pathologist said, it's a wonderful discovery, but the determination of death is my field. I'll leave archaeology to you. You leave the determination of death to me." So after a few days, he investigated the skeleton. He found, in fact, that the archaeologist was exactly correct, that the skeleton was roughly 3,000 years old, and it died of heart failure. So he called him up. He said, "How did you know that? That's such an extraordinary thing that you were able to discern that." He said, "Well, he was holding a piece of paper that said, 'I bet 10,000 shekel on Goliath.'" It is with great hesitation that I speak about this topic. And to be honest, I am petrified that people will walk away from any such presentations and believe that they can make decisions or conclusions based on these kinds of presentations. I assume you all realize here, as a professional conference, that is absolutely categorically not the case. And of course, in any of these end-of-life issues and discussions, there are people who have had personal experience, and this will evoke certain memories for people as well. What I would like to do in our brief time this morning is to understand the medical issues that pertain to end-of-life care, appreciate the medical and cultural milieu in which medical decisions are made, facilitate PSOC for end-of-life issues, supplement and complement, I already complimented the presentation, the wonderful presentation of Rabbi Dr. Glatz. I will carve out some areas, expand on some areas that he mentioned briefly, and perhaps touch on some areas that he didn't get a chance to discuss. And there will be a question and answer period afterwards, which hopefully we can flesh out the issues and clarify some of the points and concerns that you have individually. And the topics that I will be discussing to some extent are quality of life rabbinic sources, DNR, of course, DNR versus DNI, which we'll clarify, coma and persistent vegetative state, which has some interesting new literature, which will force a reevaluation of that issue as well in the 21st century, disconnecting the ventilator, active euthanasia, and the doctrine of the double effect. Now, Rabbi Dr. Glatt mentioned a number of issues related to quality of life and qualities. What I would like to share with you is a few of the rabbinic sources which bear on this topic, sources which have been discussed in the halachic literature, sources which aren't necessarily purely halachic. They're agadic, many of them, midrashic. Yet they give us an indication of the halachic sensitivity to the notion of quality of life. So here we have one of the tragic stories which we read during the year. We read on Yom Kippur. The story of Reb Chanina ben Tradyon, who was caught teaching Torah and was sentenced to death by the Romans. And the tragic story reads, Heviu v'karchu b'sefer Torah. They brought him, they wrapped him in the Sefer Torah, and they wrapped cotton wool around him, and they set him alight, tragically. Kadesh lo teitzei nishmasu mehera. And the sole purpose of putting this cotton, which was actually water-soaked cotton, around his body is to lengthen the suffering that he had in the actual course of his death. So tragically, his students and his own daughter were standing beside him when to witness this horror. And Amru lo bito, his daughter said to him, Abba, erecha b'kach, how can I see you like this? And his students said to him, Rebbe, ma taroe, what do you see, etc., etc. Apa tapsach picha tikonis b'cha esh. So his students beseeched him, Rebbe, you're in the process of dying already. Open your mouth. Allow the flames to consume you, so you'll suffer less. The result is clear. The end result is clearly known. So what was his response? A very instructive response. Aval lehen mutav shiyidlena mishenosna v'al yachbol hu ba'atzmo. It is preferable that the one who bestowed life should be the one to take life away. I should not hasten my own death. Now this... And the postscript to this, which I unfortunately don't have here in the text, the postscript is that a Roman centurion observing this asked of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyon, if I remove the cotton-soaked sponges from around you, which will in essence allow you to die sooner, will you promise me that I will get the world to come? And as the Gemara recounts, indeed, he acceded to that request. The centurion removed the cotton-soaked sponges. Shortly thereafter, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyon died, and the centurion jumped into the fire, and both of them, is recounted, were the beneficiaries of the world to come. So the question, which is discussed extensively in the rabbinic literature, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradyon just answered his students. Said, God wanted me to die. Mutav shiyidlena mishenosna, preferable that the one who bestowed life should be the one to take away life. So he said, I'm not going to open my mouth yet. Just a moment later, he acceded to the request of the centurion and allowed the centurion to remove the cotton-soaked sponges. So what's the difference between the two? So the traditional difference, and this is a passage which has been analyzed extensively, the traditional difference is actively hastening death versus removing an impediment to death. And this is something which Rabbi Dr. Glad alluded to, language which finds its expression extensively in end-of-life discussions. So opening his mouth would hasten his death. He would die a sooner death as a result of opening his mouth, and he is responsible for causing the occurrence of that death. Yet, the removal of the sponges is considered removing an impediment to death and allowing the flames to consume him. And we could argue that point, and Rabbi Dr. Glatt mentioned, the distinction between removing and withdrawing is one which halacha clearly espouses, but the secular literature does not agree with. And here is the story of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. I apologize, I'm not sure what transpired with the transmission of the slides. And the context here, and I'll just summarize the case. The context here is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the redactor, very redactor of the Mishnah, was suffering from a severe gastrointestinal illness. And he was clearly at the end of his life. And of course he had many thousands of students, but he also had a maidservant who was extremely devoted to him, and so devoted in fact that the Gemara accounts on some occasions that she was eavesdropping on so many conversations that she was a reliable witness about Jewish law, having eavesdropped on the conversations of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi for so many years. So Salika Amsa Rebbe Le'igra. So what happened? She was his maid for so many years, and she obviously had a great love for the man. She saw he was almost dying, and she went up to pray to God, and she said, "The heavens above request the presence of Rebbe, and we down below request the presence of Rebbe. Let us below supersede the desires of above. We need him. We need him here on earth." Those below should supersede those above. But she then observed him and saw, and it's interesting the aspect that's noted in the Gemara, that because he had a gastrointestinal illness, he had to go to the bathroom many, many times a day. He used to wear his tefillin all day. The very process of taking his tefillin off, putting his tefillin on, was so extraordinarily painful for him. And her observation of this procedure made such a profound impact on her that she completely changed her tune. And she said, let the ones above take Rebbe, so that Rebbe shouldn't have to remain with this excruciating suffering any longer. What was the problem? Why wasn't her prayer answered? One of the reasons her prayer wasn't answered is because the prayers of his students were continuing incessantly to keep him alive on this earth. So how did she resolve that issue? She went up to the roof. Shakla kuza shadya me'igra la'ara ishtiku me'rachme v'nach nafshe d'Rebbe. So their prayers were incessant, were continuous prayers keeping Rebbe alive. She went up to the roof, she threw a huge boulder down on the ground, and made a thunderous clap, distracting all those praying for but a moment. And in that moment, Rebbe passed away. So here you have, again, a sensitivity of the fact that life with suffering isn't necessarily ideal. And in fact, and this is a subcategory of discussion in the rabbinic literature, the Ran in the Dorim says famously that in the context of Bikur Cholim, which is actually Rabbi Dr. Glatt wrote a wonderful book on visiting the sick on Bikur Cholim, it is clearly obligatory to visit the sick, and there are many benefits that you can bestow upon somebody when you visit them. Now, of course, you can aid them physically, you can pray for their welfare, but the Ran in Maseches Nedarim says a remarkable comment. He says, if you neglect to visit somebody, not only do you deprive them of the possibility of praying for them to get better, if they are very ill and suffering immensely, and you go and you visit and you observe this, and you assess that it's preferable that they actually not live, it's preferable that they die rather than continue in this suffering, you deny them that prayer to allow them to die. You deny them that prayer to pray for their death, which will be beneficial to them. Which is a remarkable comment, and many have written about the propriety of this, whether it has any practical impact on how you treat the patient. Pretty clearly it doesn't seem to have any practical impact on how you treat a patient. But again, an indication of sensitivity to the fact that suffering is something which the law recognizes despite the continued belief in the value of life. And the final story we have here is of a woman, and this is a session of geriatrics as our discussion, and this is a woman, a geriatric patient, who presented herself to one of the great rabbis, Rav Yossi ibn Chalafta, Masa v'isha acha sheiz kina harbe, a very, very old woman, a nanogenarian, who presented to Rav Yossi ibn Chalafta, and she said, he's kanti yosur midai. I'm too old. Me'achshav chaim shel nibulheim shan eini to'emes lo machal lo mashkev anim v'kesh yosif v'ter min olam. My life is simply not enjoyable anymore. It's time for me to go. What can I do? So, of course, she has no intent on committing suicide, God forbid. That doesn't even enter into her discussion. But she's asking for advice. What should I do? So, Amar Le, Ma mitzvah at lemuda la'asos b'chol yom. So, Yosef Chalafta says to her, what mitzvah do you generally do, that you do on a regular basis? So she says, lemuda ani afilu yesh li davar chaviv ani maneches asom ashkemes l'beis ha'knesses b'chol yom. Every single day, I go to shul. I never missed a day of shul in my entire life. So what does he tell her? He says, absent yourself from shul for 3 days. So she does. She heeds his advice. And on the third day, she passed away. So here also, this wasn't a woman who was suffering a particular medical condition. This was simply a woman who was older, who was a geriatric patient who'd lived a very, very long, healthy life. But she said, I have no desire to live anymore. So here again, I'm not saying to walk away from this and say that this is something that that's recommended for everybody to do, but clearly there is a sensitivity and acknowledgement to the fact that that suffering is something which is considered in the analysis and in the discussion. Now, one of the categories which I would like to mention in our analysis of end-of-life issues, and this is really a category within which much of the halachic discussion finds its expression, and that is the category of a goses. A goses is someone mentioned in Jewish law in a number of cases in the Talmud, and a goses is somebody who, according to the conventional definition, is someone who is on death's doorstep, who is assumed that within a very short period of time, roughly 3 days according to the Talmud, to likely not survive. His prognosis is 3 days or less. So the one aspect which is absolutely essential, which the Shulchan Aruch established for us, is hagoses, and this is really the patient we're talking about, somebody who's terminally ill, is on the verge of death, harehu kechai l'chol dvar. Despite the fact that this individual will, by all accounts, or very high percentage, die within the next 3 days, right now, when you are treating this patient, he is treated like absolutely any other human being. You treat that patient like a 20-year-old healthy person that walks into the emergency room. Harayu kechai l'chol dvarav, you have to treat them as if they are completely alive. So you do not make preparations for their death. You don't call the funeral home. You don't make preparations about what's going to happen after the demise. And the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch mention a number of particular things which you can and cannot do, which we won't go into detail today, about treatment of patients at the end of life. But the bottom line, let me go back, just to catch the proper phase. So it does mention here, usher, you are certain things you're allowed to do and not allowed to do for the goses. So in this category of a goses, you're for sure not allowed to do anything which hastens the death of this individual. But you can, however, remove certain things or do certain activities which might allow, quote, nature to take its place. But to do something like moving the eyelids or closing the eyelids, based on the Rambam, kolam ameitz mitzias nefesh areza shofech damim, and that is clearly prohibited. And you cannot do anything, and we'll talk about this a little more in a moment, which will hasten the death, etc., etc. However, aval yesham davar shegorein ikuv mitzias nefesh, if there is an impediment to this individual's death, kegon sheish samach laosav bayis kol dofek. So, for example, if there's somebody chopping wood next door, and that rhythmic noise of the chopping of wood is keeping that individual alive, that you can stop. Mutter l'hasir misham, de'ein b'zeh ma'isa klal, elishem me'isir hamoneya. Because there you are not doing something actively to hasten the death of the individual. Again, returning to this notion that we talked about, Chanina ben Tradion, elishem me'isir hamoneya. You're removing the impediment to death. Now, how this all-important siman in Shulchan Aruch translates into reality is a matter of great complexity. And in fact, some people argue that all these things that are mentioned that one can indeed remove are not even medical treatments. The only thing you can remove from an individual are segulos, or non-medical treatments, but any actual medical treatment you may not be able to technically remove from somebody. But those are matters which are discussed by contemporary authorities. But this is an aspect of this which I wanted to focus on. Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, in his analysis of this particular halachic paradigm of goses, highlights one dimension, a dimension which is really a fundamental key to the development of his approach to the treatment of a patient at the end of life. And he writes, "Depashut shehu mitzad hayisurim sheyesh lad goses v'zeh." What's the reason why we're allowed to withhold treatments from a goses? You're allowed to remove an impediment to the death of a goses. The reason is because the goses is suffering. Shemitzad hayisurim, debaleka yisurim, haleka shum tam sheyatira afusalik dvarim hamakim and tzias nefesh. Because if the person wasn't suffering, why would you believe for a moment that you could withhold any treatments from such an individual or potentially remove impediments to the death of an individual? So this notion of pain was the assumption that he used in his analysis of treatments of patients at the end of life. And many of the post-scheme today who deal with practical issues about whether you're not allowed to remove or remove certain treatments, which Dr. Glatt discussed in more specific detail about the different types of treatments, are largely premised on the fact that this individual is an unremitting, continuous, intractable pain. Not only do we have no mitzvah to continue this pain, it is usur for us to continue this pain. So we therefore have the obligation not to continue these patients' life in suffering. Having said that, there is an opinion, which Rabbi Dr. Glatt alluded to, that suffering has innate, intrinsic, theological value. And Tzitz Eliezer is one of the postmen who espouses this notion. And he actually writes, I'll just summarize his position. In essence, he says that pain is not a license to withhold treatment. Pain has theological value. And the more pain that one suffers in this world, the less pain someone suffers in the world to come. Now, of course, translating this into the practical medical reality is not such a simple matter. So, for example, does that mean if you have a headache, you shouldn't take a Tylenol? Because my suffering of taking a headache is theologically so helpful that it'll save me from Yisurin in the world to come. So how this translates practically is somewhat of a complicated matter. Suffice it to say that there are opinions, clearly in end-of-life issues, that would not allow you to remove any treatments on the basis of suffering, because suffering has innate theological value. So many of these issues were previously addressed. Is it ever permitted to withhold care? And the answer is yes. Clearly, in many circumstances where it is halachically permitted, if yes, what is the halachic framework? The goseis is the halachic framework, or intractable pain is the halachic framework. One of the issues which requires analysis is how the goseis is translated into a contemporary definition of the patient in the ICU. This, which Dr. Glatt addressed, are the wishes of the patient taken into consideration, and can a family member decide on behalf of a patient without decision-making capacity? The two existing documents, which now have really become similar documents, are the RCA Living Will and the Aguda Healthcare Proxy. They have both really become a healthcare proxy. And this is just sort of a technical point which I would like to mention. As an ER physician, I am the one who receives these patients when they come in tragically with emergent end-of-life issues. And I have to review the documentation about what these patients request and don't request. So very often in the past, although it's fallen out of vogue for reasons which I'll explain presently, people often had the living wills, which were extensive documents with very detailed case scenarios. If I am in case A, then you should do such and such. If I'm case B, then you should do such and such. If I have a stroke, if I have a heart attack, if I'm conscious, if I'm not conscious, if there's 5% chance that I might live, etc., etc. The bottom line is that these documents, while seemingly thought to be useful, were actually not useful at all to the clinician, and virtually uninterpretable to the clinician, and either uninterpretable or variously interpretable, which means that if I was on call, I would interpret that document differently than if one of my colleagues was on call. So if you ask a lawyer about a document that can be interpreted multiple different ways, and I think Rafi will concur with me, as another ER physician, it's not a useful document. What is clearly more useful, and what we all advocate, is the appointing of a proxy. And a proxy, in essence, is the surrogate decision maker for the patient. That person is the one that the physicians deal with, and in essence, that person will be a decision maker for the patient. And that proxy would have to be in dialogue with the post-sec to determine which one of the treatments could or could not be employed, and we'll talk about a few of those. This I'll gloss over in light of the previous presentation, and I'd like to spend a few moments on the following topic, and that is the comatose patient. Now, Moshe Feinstein had mentioned that a patient who suffers, we have a license to withhold treatment. Now, what about a patient who's unconscious, has no clear communicative ability, and whose suffering is questionable physiologically? They're non-sentient, and for all we know, this person has no communicative ability and no ability to sense pain. does a comatose patient in fact experience pain? And one thing to clarify, which we'll have a session on Sunday on the definition of death, there's a lot of misunderstanding of what comatose is and differentiating comatose from a patient who is brain dead. Coma definitionally means someone who has no consciousness. Brainstem death, which is what is relevant to the organ transplantation, which will be discussed very extensively on Sunday, is not comatose patient. Coma is not brain death. Those are two clearly distinct medical conditions. And to give you an idea of the complexity of coma, you know, the classic Plum and Posner diagnosis of stupor and coma is a book, you know, about this thick, just on coma alone. Thousands of pages of the analysis and definition of coma, which is a spectrum. It's not one patient who has coma and there's all many different types of many, many different types of coma. A comatose patient per se does not have a terminal condition. So by virtue of the fact that someone is comatose and not conscious doesn't mean that they have a terminal condition from which they will die in any short period of time. And the classic case for this was the Terry Schiavo case. I'm sure many of you in this room are familiar with the Terry Schiavo case. And the epitaph that was clearly written by her husband and not by her parents, for those of you who are familiar with the case, was Schiavo, Teresa Marie, born December 3rd, 1963, departed this earth February 25th, 1990, which is when she had her respiratory arrest and when she went into coma, at peace March 31st, 2005, which is when she died after a long-standing debate about removing her feeding tube. Now, would, without going into details of the case, would halacha countenance, for those of you who are unfamiliar, it was tragically a case of a young woman who'd suffered an arrest and was in a persistent vegetative state or coma, not believed to have any consciousness whatsoever. And there was a debate between her husband, who had requested to remove the feeding tube to allow her to die, and her parents, who maintained that she had some level of consciousness and some level of interactivity, and there were videos on the web and neurological testimony on both sides. Would halacha have countenanced removing the feeding tube in this case? The answer is a categorical no. Under no circumstances would halacha have allowed you to remove the feeding tube in this case. Halacha generally, in very rare circumstances, would allow you to withhold the feeding tube, but in this case, she had absolutely no terminal condition whatsoever. Could have lived for many years. And the issue also is that where a secular society and quality of life issues invade many of these decisions and analyses, makes a distinction between the conscious and the unconscious in that perhaps the person of coma has lesser quality of life. In the eyes of halacha, this is an extremely essential point, just because someone is comatose does not diminish in any way, shape, or form the infinite value of that individual's life. So we do not treat the comatose patient less than the non-comatose patient from those issues. So is a comatose patient treated differently in the eyes of halacha? No. Is the requirement for food or to treat infections different for the comatose patient? Now, I don't want to say that there are no distinctions. I'm making it black and white for the purposes of our discussion. Every case should be asked to a posek. There may be nuances of differentiation. By and large, they're treated the same. Is a comatose patient considered to be suffering from intractable pain such that treatments can be withheld? So we just said that the theory underlying removal of treatment from Moshe Feinstein is that the patient is suffering, the patient's in pain. Now, if a patient's comatose, the medical society believes that this patient isn't suffering from pain. So perhaps the license to withhold treatment is no longer there. And you might have to be more aggressive in your therapy for a patient who's comatose because they're not feeling any pain. But Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't pass in that way. He actually believes that the individual, even if they're unconscious, even if they're comatose, that individual is considered to be suffering, albeit existentially, and you have a license to withhold treatment. I'm going to now discuss for a few moments this new and exciting literature, which might force us to reevaluate the whole notion of comatose patients and the treatment of comatose patients. Beginning back in 2006, they started some very interesting research, which is continuing and, of course, not completed, but is sparking the interest of many in the neurological field. And it began with the following study. It was a study of patients who are in a persistent vegetative state, the people who have believed by all to have no communicative ability whatsoever. And they took these patients and they subjected them to a test called a functional MRI. Now, functional MRI, or similarly a PET scan, is a test that can determine the function of the brain in real time. So a CAT scan or an X-ray is a static picture. It's like taking a photograph. A PET scan is like taking a movie. A PET scan or a functional MRI actually sees the brain in real time, the function of the brain. So what they did is they took a number of healthy volunteers, and they asked them a number of questions while they're sitting in a chair. Said, imagine yourself walking through your room at home. Imagine yourself playing tennis. And they looked at the scan of the brain, and certain areas lit up. You're playing tennis, the frontal lobe lit up a little bit, and so they're imagining the action of playing tennis. And they put a number of patients in persistent vegetative state or thought to have no communicative ability into the functional MRI to see if there is any brain light up. And patient after patient after patient, nothing. Then one patient went into the scanner. And I'm sure the technician was probably sleeping at this time. And all of a sudden, they asked the questions of this patient, and all of a sudden, slowly, the areas of the brain started to light up. The exact same areas of the brain that started to light up for the normal, healthy volunteers. Yet this person was believed to have been a patient in a persistent vegetative state. Now, of course, there's misdiagnosis. And of course, there are patients who are believed to be in a persistent vegetative state who may have locked-in syndrome or other rare disorders. But if you look at this recent study from February 2010 in the New England Journal, which in essence repeated those studies, of 54 patients enrolled in the study, first of all, I don't know who comes up with these titles, willful modulation of brain activity and disorder of consciousness, you have to figure out exactly what the study is talking about. Of 54 patients enrolled in the study, 5 were able to willfully modulate their brain activity, which basically means 5 of the people that they thought were in persistent vegetative state and had absolutely no communicative ability whatsoever had their brain function somewhat intact. So they were sitting for years with people believing that they couldn't communicate with them whatsoever, but they actually had communicative ability all the time that they were being treated, which is frightening. It's a frightening thing. And I don't believe these 5 patients all had locked-in syndrome. So this is humbling. This is what the age that we live in. We think we know a lot. We've learned a lot. This is an area where we don't know that much. Persistent vegetative state, they're patients that we don't believe have levels of consciousness, but in fact really do have levels of consciousness. And this clearly has bearing in the halachic world also. So would this impact the psak of Moshe Feinstein in terms of withholding, withdrawing care? No, probably not. Because in fact, these patients are not only suffering existentially, they're actually suffering. They really are suffering, and no one's able to communicate with them. But Rav Eliyashiv, for example, disagrees with Rav Moshe Feinstein. He maintains that if a patient is comatose, you don't have a license to withhold treatment. You actually have to be more aggressive for the comatose patient, not less aggressive, because that patient is not suffering pain. You don't have a license to withhold treatment from that patient. So there might come a time where when you're paskening halacha for these end-of-life patients that are comatose, you might have to subject them to a functional MRI to see which subcategory of patients they are. Are there the subcategory of patients that have this type of function or who don't have this type of function? Now, Terry Schiavo would probably not have any functional MRI light up. And in fact, when they did the post on her autopsy, she had almost complete liquefaction of most of her cerebrum, of most of the part of her brain. So she was in a persistent vegetative state with brain stem function, but with no cerebral function. And if that isn't interesting enough, there's another sort of complementary form of research which has also sparked a fascinating interest. And this dates back also a few years to somewhere in the south of England, where there was a GP, a general practitioner, who had a patient who had traumatic brain injury and was comatose and was written off by a physician many years ago, not believed to have any communicative ability. And he had a spasm in his hand. And his family was very upset about the spasm, so they went to the GP and they said, can you give us something for the spasm? So the GP gave him the equivalent of Ambien, which we use actually as a sleeping medication today, very commonly prescribed sleeping medication. So lo and behold, literally within 15, 20 minutes after receiving Ambien, this patient who had been non-communicative for years began to speak and said, hello, mother. Of course, his mother had a heart attack, at the bedside. But this is also research which is continuing, and there appear to be a subset of patients who are believed to have been comatose or some form of coma, who are responding, albeit a very small percentage, who are responding to a medication which ironically is used to cause sleeping, somehow causes disinhibition of the brain to take people who have been sleeping and make them awake. So there's so much that we don't understand, and really the lesson is just the continued humility. But in the course of the this is one of those examples, by the way. This son was in a coma, heard everything for 23 years. This was one of the patients in that study in the New England Journal. And now that they know that he had a positive functional MRI, they now hooked him up to a computer where he's able to communicate with his family effectively after 23 years of being in a coma. And this isn't a patient who woke up after the coma. He was never really in a complete coma. He's still in the same physical state, but now with the computer technology, he has the ability to function. Interesting halakhic ramifications of this. If a person has these computers which can do functions for them, including working with computers, does that present issues on Shabbos of malacha, when with just thought processes, with brain processes, these patients are able to perform certain activities? And I'll just mention one other topic, and we'll open for discussion. Do I have the patient's consent to switch off the life support system? And here we'll just mention disconnecting the ventilator. And here's just one of many cases. Mrs. D. Cohn suffers from hypertension, diabetes, and congestive heart failure. She is admitted for a serious medical condition and put on a breathing machine in the intensive care unit. The Cohen family asks the rabbi, can we disconnect the life support system? Actually, I won't mention this, but I'm sure Canadians know the Golubchik case. So what I'd like to mention is this notion really, well, I'll lump these together and we'll close and we'll open for questions. It is clearly prohibited under all circumstances to perform any act which will directly and immediately result in the death of a patient. So removing the respirator, disconnecting the respirator, by almost all postmen, I think there is one, maybe two dissenting opinions, is considered to be a violation of ritzicha, of murder, when you directly and immediately remove the patient from the respirator. So, for example, I personally had a case. There was a patient who was a DNR, came into the hospital, did not have the DNR with them, and the patient was intubated. Family came in, was very angry, spoke to the geriatrician, said, my family member is a DNR, you never should have intubated them. And then the family left. And I was in the ER, I was the attending at that time, and the geriatrician was on the phone with him. Don't worry, you're right. We'll be happy to remove the respirator. Dr. Reichman is on call. Why don't you come in? Dr. Reichman will be happy to remove the respirator for you. So I said to her, excuse me, Dr. Reichman will not be happy to remove the respirator for you. And this is actually the tremendous luxury that we have in North America, I'll say, not just the United States. But in this kind of situation, I cannot and was not forced to do such a thing. And I said to her, if this is something that you want to do, then this is something that your physicians, your team will have to take care of. And in fact, one of her colleagues, a geriatric fellow, came down and removed the respirator, and the patient died shortly thereafter. But one of the things I want to hasten to add, and this is a nuanced aspect of end-of-life care, not every patient on a respirator is dependent on that respirator, and in not all scenarios will removal of the respirator inexorably lead to death. So that is a common misconception. Every single case needs to be discussed with the physician in detail. So it is not always prohibited to remove the respirator. There may be times where it is medically okay to remove the respirator, and the patient meets the so-called weaning criteria, which the respiratory therapist can help determine, and in fact can be safely removed from the respirator. But again, that's something which should be discussed in extensive detail. And this is just a good cartoon. There's a woman being tried for the murder of her husband. And she says it was assisted suicide, but he was too pig-headed to ask for it. But just in conclusion, I'll just put the slides off. this is an area of immense complexity, an area that most of us are not really capable of making the decisions on our own. Even the local rabbis that you will consult very often will have to consult others who have expertise, just like physicians need to discuss issues with consults who have greater expertise. Such is the same in the eyes of Jewish law. Hopefully both myself and Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatz have given you at least an exposure to some of these areas. And we will be delighted to discuss cases and answer questions for you in the next few minutes.